Hello and welcome. My guest today is Nebris Ibb. Nebris is a product designer at Clio, a money app that doesn't suck. That's according to them on their own website. And Nebris is interested in working with companies doing meaningful work, humankind technology and design that respects attention and adds to people's lives, and the blend of emotional well-being, technology, and design. So in this conversation, we spoke about cultivating flow, meditation, her ice bath release, masculinity / femininity, and much more. And I was originally attracted to Nebris' work because I found her writing so profound and I was just sending it so often to friends. So I hope you enjoyed this episode as well as much as I enjoyed recording it. And if you got value from the episode, go ahead and share it with somebody you think will enjoy it as well, or just tweet about it, Instagram story it, or text it to somebody you think will enjoy it too. All right, let's get right into the episode with Nebris. Thank you for coming on the podcast today. I'm really honored and humbled because there are few people who, when you stumble across their Twitter accounts, when you stumble across their words or their writing, it really hits you, or at least it hits me, and I'm like, wow, like I really want to have a conversation with this person because I find myself referring back to your ideas and your tweets a lot of my natural conversations. And so when I noticed that start happening, I started saying to myself, oh, wow, I really have to have you on the podcast. So I'm really grateful and honored for you to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. That's so sweet to say that I can feel like the warmth that's spreading across my chest, like my smile getting big. But that's the loveliest compliment that I could have when it comes to Twitter. Like what could be, I don't know if anything could be more meaningful to me than someone saying these ideas are naturally coming up when I see them or when I see your writing, I feel a sense of connection that's deeply beautiful. So I really appreciate you saying that. It means a lot. And it's a pleasure. I'm also very excited to find out about you, and I've seen what you've been doing, and I have a lot of respect and a lot of admiration as well. So
thank you. So I figured we'd go through a few of these ideas as jumping off points, and we can dive into them, how they relate to you, how you stumbled across them. There are so many questions, obviously, I'll have regarding them. But the first one that really hit me that I noticed myself refer back to many times over the past month is the idea of substances that we consume creating our work. So to quote you directly, my wacky belief is that the substances we ingest imbue the work we create. E.g., coffee creates caffeine-shaped work. If you look carefully enough, you see the patterns and imprint of caffeine. Same with nicotine, tea, sugar, or say lion's mane. Where did this idea come from? And what substances are creating your work currently?
Two nice questions. So one, where did the idea come from? It came from also a belief that I've held for a long time, that the emotional state that we're in imbues the work that we create. And my background is very much arts-based. It's tech-based and arts-based. But I spent like from the ages of 12 till 21 very obsessively drawing and painting and trying to really hone that craft. And you know, anytime you get that obsessed with a field or a practice, you end up getting into the subtleties of it. And so I remember one of the ideas that would come up to me a lot that I didn't actually articulate was the sense that the state of the artist fills the work in so many different ways, but also in a more esoteric sense, that I kind of held this belief that I was a bit embarrassed about when I was younger, that when I would stand in front of a painting in a gallery, I would be experiencing in my body some of what that artist experienced as they were creating that painting, that somehow the painting captures their emotional state. And so that was the that was the wackiest version of that belief. And, you know, when I was younger, I was like, I don't want to tell people this because they're going to think I'm a bit crazy. And like, I'm already in art school and pretty hippie-ish. So let's rein it in, you know. And then I started looking a lot at, just kind of what people were consuming day to day and the type of work that they were creating. And I felt this idea begin to shape. But the tweet came from a project that I was doing with two friends. We were shaping a venture, and in that kind of like, I was leading them through like a shaping process, like a design shaping process. And we'd sit down and we'd have these like 2 to 3 hour long meetings that ideas would come out of. And they had CBD and coffee. And so they would either take some CBD or drink coffee. And what I was noticing was how I would feel when they were drinking a lot of coffee and coming into the meetings. And then beginning to notice actually what the creations looked like when they were drinking a lot of coffee, and really noticing how that differs and how much more spaciousness there is if they're not drinking caffeine or they're using CBD or something else, right? Whatever else it is. And really starting to see ideas very much shaped by that. So then I just began playing with that and kind of looking at my work and looking at how my writing differs as well. And as for what's shaping my work right now, well, I think two things. I always joke that tea is the only thing that both sides of my heritage agree on, like the Scottish side and the Sudanese side. They all love tea. And so I drink tea. It's one of my remaining vices. And these days I really love matcha. So I'd say matcha in some way, shape or form is influencing the work that I create, especially the more like creative tech focused work.
How so? How does tea impact the work?
Sure. So I drink tea for a few reasons, I'd say. I was having a conversation with my sister. She was kind of drafting an essay. And we were playing with this idea that tea is one of the love substances in our family. My mom makes us all tea, and it's a very special kind of tea, and she kind of gives it to you as an act of love. And I think we've all developed this emotional relationship to tea where there's comfort in it. And so drinking tea is almost calming myself down, kind of soothing myself, right? And it's also a bit of focus, so I can't drink coffee. It's a bit too much for my system. But I notice when I drink tea, there's this double effect of I feel soothed, and I'm also just a little bit more focused, a little bit sharper. Mm-hmm. And the work that I create is a bit more, the image I'm getting in my head is of a square that's zooming in. And so it's a little bit less open focus. It's a little bit less kind of creatively associative, and it's a bit more moving an idea along. So if I'm writing after I've drank tea, I can kind of feel a bit more of a focus on pace and on a singular idea and on kind of getting that idea to a finish. Whereas if I'm, like writing in the morning, I haven't drank any tea, I'm much more relaxed. It's very flowy and disconnected and disjointed. It feels more like a free-form conversation. And then matcha is just the first option, the tea option, but amplified. It's a lot more about like, okay, what does this look like? What is the story that I'm telling here? How do I get this to a finish? So they kind of almost, I feel like different parts of my personality take the wheel depending on what I've consumed.
It's so fascinating because I don't think people normally think about the substances they have actually finding a way into the work that they create. In that, you mentioned about how you're noticing the square get closer and closer. And I couldn't help but think of the symbol in the middle of your Twitter header where it's like your name and then there's like a circular thing and then I love you. And I was curious what the significance of that circular thing is. I'll flash it on the screen for those watching on YouTube, but what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, I wish I had like a very cool, deeper, in-depth answer to give you. I like my background is, like I said, in the arts. It's very visual. I like visual symbols. And I remember I used to change what that symbol was or that emoji was. And it's almost just like a micro vibe capture. And to me, my favorite shape is a circle. if I were to get a tattoo, it would just be a simple circle, as much as my friends make fun of me for that. But I think there is a lot of perfection in circles. A circle is just a continuous line. And so for me, that shape symbolizes something like harmony or something like flow or contentment. It captures, I guess, something that I'm always moving towards in my life and hopefully at some point arriving at. But that's my on-the-fly answer.
I love that. And it makes me think about Rick Rubin's book where he's got two circles on the cover of it, which is also very closely tied to creativity and living a life in flow. What have you found to be, it seems like this is living a life in flow is something you think a lot about. And I'm curious what you found to be the best ways to get to that place.
Absolutely. I'd love to answer that. If it's okay, I'll hold the question and I'm actually very curious to hear what substances are fueling your work. And
for sure.
Curious to hear what you notice. And I think in that I notice this interest. When an idea grabs somebody, there's something in them that's alive related to that idea. So I'm curious what you've been playing with or feeling with in regards to how different substances maybe shape or form your work that's made that idea reflect something to you.
Yeah. So for me, I've been drinking a lot of LMNT, which is an electrolyte, and I've never drank electrolytes before. I'm actually sipping on it right now. And it's supposed to help with dehydration, and I've certainly felt that I normally would have to pee every 45 minutes, but now I can go for longer amounts of time without peeing, which sounds like a trivial thing. But if you think about getting into the flow state with something, and for me, it's like podcasting. It's like I'd have to break a podcast up often into two sections, into 45-minute sections before coming to this conclusion. And now I can go for an hour and a half or 2 hours without having to pee. And it's like, whoa, this is a game changer. This changes my life. And so, although I do think there's a benefit to going up to pee for whatever it is, because it makes you think about the work you've done in that previous 45-minute block and allows you to reflect. But regardless, it's drinking something new for the first time in the past couple of weeks has really made me think about the substances that I'm creating with. And also, I'm also very fueled by coffee as well. And my work and my pace of production is very go, go, go. Like I put out 3 podcast episodes a week and I can't help but notice that, oh, wow, coffee has probably played a role in creating this reality. So yeah, that's a couple of things. And the reason why that point really hit home for me.
Yeah, I love that. And as for dehydration, I think a lot about all of the micro changes that begin to happen in you as a result of being better hydrated and how that compounds over time and how that actually begins to very subtly also affect the work, like whether it's just the choice of word that you use or the space that you give yourself before asking a question or answering a question. And I see these things really, I just kind of see them compounding into a different vibe, for lack of a better word, a different vibe that then communicates something different. But yeah, I feel you on the dehydration.
It's good to be hydrated, and it feels good to be hydrated, and it just makes me feel whole to drink water. So what was the question that you held in the air that
yes,
I already
I've
forgot?
Got it. I've got it. You were asking about flow. You were asking about flow as a, if I remember correctly, as a sort of aim in life or something that for me I'm working towards and holding in high value in ways, if I remember correctly, that I've been cultivating that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome. Flow. So I think there's flow in terms of creative flow, or maybe when we say flow, I imagine what most people think of is getting in the zone, like getting into a space where the sense of self drops enough so that there is no separation between self and experience, creation and creator. And it's I think, one of the most beautiful, exhilarating, sober experiences, maybe other than love. And so I think of flow at that level. And then I also think of flow at a sort of life level. So kind of flowing through different aspects of life and finding more harmony in living and in self. I'm wondering which kind of flow you mean.
I meant the more internal state of flow, of flow with when you're one with the activity that you're doing. But okay, also, not to get us too sidetracked, when you're, I think flow oftentimes people talk about as something to do related to a creative work or work in general, like you're in the flow state. But it makes me think that love is just the flow state for relationships. Like when people say love, what they're actually saying is, I'm in the flow state with another human being right now. Right?
Yes, I love
that. Does that resonate?
That's a very like brain candy framing. Like I can feel my mind get excited at that. I'm like, oh, that's a fantastic analogy. I think that definitely resonates, yeah. Love as relational flow state.
Mm.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that for sure.
Because most people don't talk about, like, I'm in flow with my partner right now. They say, I'm in flow with doing this activity at work or this creative pursuit. But then when they say, oh, I'm in love, what they're actually saying is, I'm in flow right now with my partner, or with the person that I'm in love with. So going back to the creative ways of being, right? You think a lot about writing. You write very well. I'm sure in order to write that well requires some degree of getting lost in the activity of writing. What have you found to be the best ways or the best practices you've cultivated to get yourself into that state of flow before or during writing?
Mm-hmm. So I remember to go to Twitter. Somebody a few years ago tweeted something that was like, X is a life complete problem. And I was like, I really like that phrase. What is a life complete problem? And I think maybe it was like a Twitter user called Mechanical Monk, maybe. But I'll double check that, you know, just to give credit there. And he explained a life complete problem being, you know, so let's say dating is a life complete problem, where somebody's like, you know, I can't find anybody to date. And they think there might be like a few communication tips, or like might be a case of downloading the right app. And then boom, they're having like the greatest dating success. Then you start trying to like solve this problem of, I can't find a date. And you realize you like slowly have to solve your entire life. And then you come back and you're like, wow, my entire life looks different. And look at that. Now I have all of these dates. And I think sometimes, or I think for me, flow and creativity is and was a life complete problem. And I think sometimes of the, you know, I feel like you can, or at least for me, I could potentially distill my life so far into a few guiding questions. And then I can project forward to a few questions that I would be very happy spending the rest of my life answering, or like living my way into an answer to. And one of them is definitely a question that's like, how do I make without suffering? And all that means is like, how do I make while feeling very good in my body? And that also means, how do I make in flow? Because I think if I feel somatically good, if I'm sitting down and I'm relaxed and at ease, there's no contraction in the body that my attention will then narrow on. And what makes flow quite difficult for me is our contractions in the body. And so I've honestly spent a lot of time troubleshooting this. Like, this has probably been one of three guiding questions since I was 15, because I really like to make things. And I also find it very painful, or have historically found it very painful to make things. And I was like, you know what, this is kind of unfair. Like, I I'm not sure what life setup there is where you're obsessed with something, which is creativity and making, and you also find that very thing incredibly painful. So that's a bit of preamble and context to like get into answering your question. So cultivating flow has been a bit of a journey in that sense. And I'd say the first, I want to say the first lever, but it's not a lever, maybe the first phase of that journey was very emotional and continues to be very emotional in that I think, I really do think it's emotions all the way down. Like everything that I come to, I see it through this lens of emotions. And so I had to spend a lot of time noticing what would create emotional disturbances in my system as I was making work. Okay, so what begins to generate suffering in the body? And the first one was trying to make work while simultaneously holding an image of what that perfect piece of work would be. And so I couldn't be in flow because I was always split into two. I'm making the thing that I'm making, and I'm constantly comparing it to an ideal image in mind. That's just a very subconscious process that's going on. It's just not nice. It really is like driving while you know, hitting the brakes. You're like, oh, it's a lot of energy and a lot of friction. And so really beginning to notice, okay, that's always going on. How do I begin to drop this idealized image that I hold? And one of the ways that I do that is by learning to get more present. And that kind of sounds very spiritual and esoteric, but I think being more present, I'm a little bit obsessed with being more present these days, especially over the last month. And it's because I see how much better life is in every way when I'm just more here. And that means like I'm looking at your face, I'm hearing the sound of the car outside, I'm noticing these words that are coming out of my mouth. So becoming more present in work meant like a fair bit of meditation practice and also a fair bit of emotional work, because a lack of presence, as a friend of mine, Anita, has been saying, is actually a symptom of not feeling safe. If you're not safe, the mind very beautifully comes in and says, hey, let me show you something that's going to generate better feelings in you. Because, and I at least see my mind as a very friendly, though often misguided agent who's trying to just keep me feeling good, you know? And so, okay, no, it's like, all right, I don't feel safe. I'm kind of distracted. I have an image of perfection that I'm striving towards. And all of those things take me out of presence. And so a few different strategies over time and over my life to start kind of honing those areas. So, okay, I can be a bit more present. And then I'd say like a very intentional effort that was almost like exposure therapy to make bad work. Like I always think of, you know, the Neil Gaiman commencement speech that's called Make Good Art. And I always have like in my notes, make good art, like stroked out, and it's just like make bad art and like get very comfortable with making bad art, because it became very clear to me that when I made something bad, I felt bad. It attached to my sense of self. It's like, I am bad. And it felt quite crucial to begin to disconnect those two. No, I am not bad. Sure, I can create many bad things, and I will, because there's a lot that I enjoy. That doesn't need to create these feelings of shame that I was experiencing before. And so just actually making a lot of bad work and sharing it on the internet quite a lot, and just being like, you know what? It's kind of a shitty piece of writing, and it's there. It lives on the internet, and I'm not going to take it down. And like, it's okay, because I think that's probably the worst that I can do, and it's there. So I'd say those are some of the larger kind of like life complete actions and experiments that led to a lot more relaxation and a lot more comfort. And then that makes it relatively easy to get into flow. Like I almost feel the mind and body very naturally seek flow, especially with work, with creative work. Like they kind of want to get into flow. It's a very pleasurable state. So as long as nothing gets in the way, or it's kind of the removal of contractions and blockers, then things flow very nicely.
There's so many.
I'll stop there, because I feel like a lot of words, so many words.
Well, there's so much there that I want to talk about and ask about. Let's start with the first thing that comes to mind, which is about the meditation practice. What did that look like for you, and how did you get into meditation?
Sure. So I grew up, I grew up in a specific sect of Sufism, which is it's a mystical, Sufism's the mystical sect of Islam, and then within it there are different sects. And I was raised in a particular one, which is very musical and meditative, and the main goal or aim of it is enlightenment. And enlightenment, at least within the sect, lots of people will debate and say, like, no, that's wrong. But within the sect, it's the idea that losing the self into God or into love for God. So it's a very devotional, love-based practice. And then, you know, as I grew up, I had my own beliefs and philosophies and religious explorations, but I had a lot of foundation in meditation, at least Sufi-based meditation, which was a lot of chanting and a lot of like meditation circles with drums and the sense of essentially creating altered states while sober, using nothing but the voice and music. And I spent a lot of time with my dad when I was growing up, so I would do a lot of that with him, and I would go to all of these meditation circles. So that was that, and then I kind of had my arc of falling out of Islam and going into a lot of like critical philosophy and rationalism and all of these fun things that we do. And then when I was maybe 17, I started exploring Eastern philosophy because rationalism made the world very non-magical, and that actually just wasn't all that pleasant. And in that came across, you know, like different practices in Buddhism. I am not a Buddhist, but really enjoyed Buddhism almost as a toolkit for exploring my experience, and as a very evidence-based or direct experience-based practice. All Buddhism asked me to do was to use lenses to look at my experience and to kind of like come up with my own conclusions. And so there were the sort of like insight meditations, concentration meditations. Then when I was 18, I became like an assistant to an Advaita Vedanta teacher, and through him started learning practices that were kind of the beginning of what I would now call IFS, which is internal family systems. They were parts work practices, but those started with a sort of allowing practice, which was my first very much body-based meditation practice. And it was really sitting. And every meditation practice I'd done in that first year was very head-based. It was very much observing thoughts or insight-based practices where I would really focus on maybe like the thought of I, or investigate where the sense of self sat in awareness. And this was the first meditation practice that was like, no, what you're going to do is you're going to drop attention below the neck and notice that there's an entire world there of sensations, of everything. And you're just going to be with it. And you're not going to interfere with it. There is no action to take. The whole practice is returning attention to the body. And that was pretty incredible and life-changing, and very tough at first, actually. So that formed essentially the foundation of my meditation practice. And since then, it's been dipping into a lot of different tools and techniques and, and meditation schools and philosophies. But I'd say I returned very much to something that's kind of like open field awareness, which is just not taking any action, not doing anything, and noticing what arises in attention and awareness, and this dropping of attention into the body and just kind of letting it be there and noticing what's alive.
That's beautiful. How has that helped inform your own creativity?
Well, how has meditation informed my creativity?
Yeah.
It's changed my relationship to myself and reality at a very fundamental level. I feel people say that a lot, and I sometimes think or guess that to many people that sounds very maybe like BS-ish or just overly esoteric. But like my moment-to-moment experience of reality is different. And that means everything that I create and do and engage in is different. And so I'd say even just the quality of my attention as I'm sitting down to write or to design is different as a result of meditation. And also on a very simple and practical level, the Like the level of suffering that I experience on a moment-to-moment level is dramatically different. And I think going back to the idea that our emotional state imbues the work that we create, I really feel that people who are happy or content or just at peace, they're almost like an open channel for creativity. They are a sort of... My mind won't give me a better image right now than like a pipe and lights moving through that pipe without any obstruction, right? So I feel that in suffering less and in just finding more spaciousness and peace, ideas move through me much more easily, and I also have less ownership of them, and I have more ability to actually ride out some of the challenges of executing ideas, because there can be frustration and contraction and tension in that. I would love, if it's okay, to also ask you about your meditation practice and what that looks like.
For sure. So, for me, it's currently 60 minutes before I go to sleep, and just like lights out, eyes closed, a blanket over me, just letting the thoughts come, whatever they are. And I find that it's remarkable how much better I sleep at night after doing that. I would ideally like to do it in the morning as well, so that I feel so much more present after doing it. And so that's probably why I'm going to sleep better, is because I've cleared out a lot of this stuff. But then it's like, what about interacting with people when I wake up, right? So I want to give people that gift as much as I can of presence. And the best way to do that is to clear my own stuff before entering into conversations and talking to people. Although I do feel as if I get some sort of benefit from doing it at night as well that carries over to the day. But yeah, that's my current practice, and it's changed my life, really.
It's beautiful. How did you land on that as a practice?
I started doing 20 minutes in the morning because my friend, he was operating with a different energy about him. I would look at his tweets and be like, there's something different about this guy. This was in 2018, and I could just sense it. And I was like, oh, he meditates? Okay, I'll try it out. And I tried it out. I was like, this changed my life. This is really important. This is impactful. And then I stumbled across Naval doing a 60-minute, 60-day meditation challenge. And I started to do that. And then I started in May of 2020. And then by July, so literally 2 months later, when the challenge was done, I started the podcast. And so if you think about the one true thing that has stayed, And so I directly attribute getting so clear on myself and getting clear on everything to creating the thing that has helped me more than anything. So,
wow. That's incredible. Wow. I was actually very curious. I wanted to ask you what drove starting the podcast, and we've kind of like very luckily and nicely landed on it. Do you remember much of what that clearing process looked like, and what was it that you became clear on that the output was the podcast?
So there were a bunch of different scenarios that I was forced to reconcile with when you sit down and you close your eyes. And at first it's just, the things that come up are very trivial in nature. And then you start to get really deep really quickly, because you're like, I'm going to be here for 60 minutes. And on the sixth day of doing that, you're not lying to yourself anymore. You're telling the truth of what you actually believe and what is actually in your heart and the things that you've been suppressing. And so for me, I've told this story before, but it was one situation where senior year of high school, a kid shoved me into a locker, and it had really impacted my own journey into like lifting weights, and it left me with a lot of anger and upsetness and feeling like I wasn't a man. And so coming to terms with that and forgiving the kid in my head, and also forgiving myself for holding on to it for 8 years, really made an impact in clearing a lot of stuff. And then afterwards, it was like relationships with girls in college and just like forgiving myself for the way I treated them. And like all of it was just like, wow, that was baggage. And when the baggage came out, what was left was me being able to talk to people like you, who I've never met, about these things, and also confront myself about these things as well, and be like, oh, wow, you didn't act in your highest ideal in this time in your life. And so that stays with you. It stays with you when you're not acting in your highest ideal. Like, you know, your mind and body keeps a score of that. And so you need to confront that, and or you don't have to confront it, but confronting it leads to growth in some respect and allows you to attack the next thing in your life with more clarity and purpose. And so those were a couple of key things that I released. And then afterwards, now I do it, and it's fun for me to spend time with myself because I enjoy the voice in my head. I'm friends with the voice in my head. And that is the place that I wish and hope and pray that everyone gets to at some point, because it is a magical experience. You are living in, like, you can go into any room you want. You can talk to any person you want. You can approach anyone. You can approach yourself. You can have difficult conversations with yourself and others. As you can tell, I get really excited about this topic because I think it's the most important thing any of us could ever do. But yeah, that's been my experience.
I love it. Get excited. Your excitement is infectious and I react to it. So it's fantastic. First of all, I love the meditation practice that you landed on, because I feel a lot of people come into meditation with this, I don't know, just this like authoritarian inside of themselves and this idea that it has to be like super disciplined, super strict, super hard, kind of like the gym, you know, like if it doesn't hurt, those muscles aren't growing. And that's a whole different topic we can get into. But I think I notice when I'm like talking with my friends who were troubleshooting their meditation practices, a lot of it comes back to, hey, how can this be pleasurable? Why not work with your nature? Because what's pleasurable, we do. At least I know for me, what's pleasurable, I do. So why not just work with that? And I love that practice. I love that it sounds like you're lying down, so the body is relaxed, which is a beautiful start. And it's a lot of allowing and observation. And I wanted to ask you said, you know, there is this baggage, or that there is this kind of unprocessed data is what I was hearing. And this idea of confronting it. And I'm wondering, is the confrontation being aware of it? Because there is this idea that, you know, like awareness is all that's needed. Awareness is the action, actually. Or was the confrontation something that had more steps to it than that? So becoming aware of a memory or a thought and then doing something about it. What did that look like for you?
So I think the reason why people view awareness as the end in some respect is because once you are aware, the rest of the steps will naturally follow. Whereas when you're unaware, it's like you don't even know what to do. But for me, the thing that I did after I was aware of those problems in my past was forgive myself and the other person for the issues of them. And that to me was what the action items were that really helped solidify it. But because it's like, I could be aware of that and I could not forgive that person, but if I held on to the anger while being aware of it for 2 years, I don't think that would have done nearly as much as me saying, you know what? It's all good. Like, that was 2012 and I was a kid at this time and this person was a kid and they were figuring themselves out, and I forgive you and I forgive myself for holding on to it. I think that to me is like where the real impact came from, the forgiveness.
I love that. And what did your forgiveness process look like?
It was pretty simple. It was pretty simple of like, as soon as it came up, I was just like, oh, I forgive you. And like, it was almost like a sense of wonder of like, oh, like that's so fun. That's incredible that was in my head for all these years. Wow. Like, I'm so happy I discovered that. And now like I can actually process it. And so my first reaction was just like, I forgive you, the kid who did it. I also forgive myself. So that's what it looked like for me.
That's incredible. I love that. I was hoping the answer would be something like that, and that forgiveness is like a straightforward mental action or mental posture.
Yeah.
And the reason it doesn't naturally happen is because we don't adopt that posture. And so what it takes is noticing and then saying, actually, I'm going to flick the switch and I'm going to flick it towards forgiveness. That to me feels very hopeful to know it's not like a 60-day process where you sit and...
I'm sure it can be, and it's yeah. totally dependent on the trauma or the situation, potentially, right? Like,
yep.
Someone shoved me into a locker, like that. That's not nearly as like it could have been a lot worse, and people deal with a lot worse. And so, I want to keep that in mind when giving that advice or saying that is like maybe for some people it's not easy, but for me in this situation it was. So,
very thoughtful. That's a very thoughtful point to make and add. Yeah, I agree.
What was the 15-minute ice bath that you did? And was it any similar to the release and the forgiveness that I described?
Yeah. I've had a crazy 2 to 3 months. We had an idea. Some friends and I, who I'm doing some work with, they run a studio, a venture design studio called Modern Mantra. And it's in many ways, a vehicle for experimentation and for experimenting into work styles and ways of blending work and living that feel very exciting for us and feel very exciting for the co-founders as well. And so we were jamming on new directions for the studio. And the idea came up of what would it look like if we ran essentially design cycles, venture cycles, in the same way as retreats. So, you know, we're all very spiritually leaning. We like our retreats. A lot of our friends do. And retreats are like, they're this experience, right? It's some of the most beautiful form of experience design I've seen and I've witnessed are retreats. And so I started playing with this idea of, okay, well, what would these cycles that we're running look like as retreats? And then that evolved into what would it look like to do a retreat together, a few of us, and also run a cycle. And, you know, if we're really about the things that we say we're about, could we run an experiment where we are doing pretty intense emotional work together and then also doing work together, what's traditionally called work? And some way, somehow we ended up doing it. And the ice bath was part of the retreat that we were doing. It was a 30-day retreat called The Warrior's Journey. And it was very intense, as the name suggests. And there was a lot going on. There was a lot of growth. And every week there was a portal themed around one of the elements. And the portal was all about overcoming fears or overcoming difficulties and just finding ways to be with discomfort. So this retreat was very interesting for me because its approach is maybe the way that I've primarily functioned in the world for most of my life. But in the last 2 years or so, I really felt myself beginning to move out of what I now think of as very yang, masculine-oriented personal development, right? The warrior's journey, right? It's the path of conquering and discipline, kind of overpowering and overcoming. And I felt... yeah, very naturally in the last few years that actually maybe my growth lies a lot more in the path of softness and sweetness and pleasure and nurture. And what does it look like to begin allowing those parts of myself to grow and to express? And actually, what does personal development look like if it's a lot more yin? What does that look like? So those are, not to get too sidetracked, but those are things I've been feeling into a lot and thinking about a lot. And the ice bath was one of the challenges. And I have to say the warrior's journey as a whole was incredible. I really, really, really love the person who created it. So I have this different relationship to it. But yeah, there was this ice bath challenge, 15 minutes, which is the longest that I'd ever done. And actually like a year and a half ago, I couldn't do any cold water exposure. Or I did, I forced myself to do a lot of it. But it was incredibly painful, like physically painful. And I'd been doing some ice baths while I was in the place where this retreat was being held, which is a sort of eco-village, experimental co-living village called Zunia. And so I'd been doing first like a 2-minute ice bath and noticing wow, this feels pleasurable. I'm not approaching this from a place of forcing myself. I'm really sitting with myself and noticing my reactions before I get into the water. And actually, I only get into the tub of ice when I feel internal harmony, when enough parts of myself say, yeah, okay, we see why we want to do this as an internal council or collective, rather than one part saying, no, this is good for us. So let's do it. Let's jump into that ice bath. And so, yeah, there was the ice bath challenge, and I was amazed and surprised and just, I know, impressed. It's been like this incredible checkpoint for reflecting on all of the ways that the person that I am has changed and all of these differences, and experiencing them while immersed in a challenge like that, or in an experience like that. So I got into the ice, and with an ice bath, as you probably know, like the first minute is the hardest. And then once you've done the first minute, the body begins to settle into the experience. Yeah, it also helped that we were doing it in, like, it was really hot. It was really hot outside. So the first minute it's hard, but also I'm like, thank God, it's like a bit of relief from this sun and this heat. And so I got in, and before getting in, sat, did some breathing, just noticed any part of myself that felt in any way, shape, or form like it was being pushed into this experience, and just created some space to hear what it had to say, how it was feeling. And very quickly, yeah, just felt like internally, I actually was very curious to see if I could meet those 15 minutes, if I could kind of hit that goal or not. And I also went into it feeling very clear that if at any point a part of me or my body said, this is painful, this doesn't feel good, this feels harmful, that I would take myself out, regardless of what anybody around me would think or whether it would hit my ego or not. That was kind of the promise. So I got in, you know, a bit of shock, a bit of feeling refreshed, and just focused on my breathing and let that guide me, a lot of just slow exhalations. And then I felt into the sensations of the ice and really began to notice if there was any part of my experience that was pleasurable, and let my attention sit in it, because then that would begin to grow. And then also just opened up myself to anything in me that said, hey, no more, I'm done with this. And at the same time, I began to notice, like you were saying, you now like the voice inside of you. And I had this very beautiful moment where the voice inside of me began to say, hey, you're okay, you're safe, I've got you, no harm is going to come to you. My role and job is to protect you. You're okay, you're safe, I've got you. And just hearing that as a mantra being repeated really began to relax me. And so yeah, like 5 minutes in, all good. About the 6 minute mark, I realized, like, okay, I can probably just be here for quite a while. Like, it's a little bit uncomfortable, but it's very doable, and there are quite lovely points of it. And then a few minutes in, my body was tremoring the entire time. And if you've read around, you know, like emotional release, excuse me, or trauma-related work, I have this belief or this idea that actually tremors are emotional release. And so kind of noticed my body tremoring and tried not to block those tremors, to just let it be, even though it looks kind of weird and wacky. And like, you know, there are photographers taking videos of me exactly, you know, and there are like people watching me as I'm in the ice bath, but I'm like, oh, it's okay. Let's just be weird. Like if this is an opportunity to release, let me ride this way. So the tremors take over my entire body. They're quite intense, and they're part of the cold, but they also I feel emotion moving, but I have no narrative. There are no thoughts related to the emotion. There's just the emotional experience. And at some point I start like gasping and crying. And again, I can really feel and see I'm not crying because I'm in pain. There's no pain. And it's not the ice bath that's making me cry. It's this emotion that's moving through my body. And again, just see if I can create space to let the crying happen. So it kind of passes through, and then my body begins to calm down again. Again, I just kind of go in and out of these waves a bit. And yeah, at some point they're like, hey, 15 minutes, like your time is done. You know, you're good to get out now. And that was it. That was the ice bath story.
You tweeted that at 10 minutes in, you started chanting prayers.
Yes.
that from your childhood, was that, what was that related to? Do you believe the release of the trauma or the tremors?
Potentially. I have no idea. Yeah. Like I could create an answer. I'd definitely be theorizing, but I have no idea. And that was pretty incredible to watch as well. Like to see, to begin hearing my voice speaking in Arabic and saying words that I didn't feel I was intending to say was also pretty cool and very, I mean, it feels very psychedelic. It's very much an altered state at that stage. And yeah, potentially they are related, but it was, yeah, it was quite phenomenal to watch and experience.
You said something before that I want to highlight, and that's about how you made an agreement with yourself that you were going to honor your feelings, even if it was weird or it seemed, or people would make fun of you or razz you about whatever you were feeling. And I personally think that this is like the cheat code to life, is if you can accurately act on the feelings that you are feeling without regard to what other people are going to think about them. If you can do that, think about how much of your world gets opened up and how much you can actually do whatever it is that is in your mind and in your heart. And so what have you done to get better at that skill?
Yeah, that's a beautiful question. I agree, and we can talk about it after. Like I'm curious how you landed on that viewpoint. And you know, you say it was such emotion that I'm like, you must have had some interesting experiences to get you there. And yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. Honestly, I feel like it's my work and it continues to be my work. To me, what you're talking about is the opposite of suppression. It's full unfiltered expression. It's like internal alignment and a knowing and an ability to feel and see what's going on. And then just letting it be without all the blockers that come along the way. I also love how much you're smiling. Like your smiles are so encouraging. I'm like, yeah, okay.
Because you're reflecting back to me in your own way all the things that I think and I've experienced. So that's where the smiling is coming from.
Beautiful. And it's a beautiful feeling. And as you're talking about this, I get that excitement as well. And so this like expression or getting to a place of being able to express without fear is the way that I think of it, because I feel a lot of my life, at least, has been colored by this fear of what other people feel and think. And it's like this, it's a deep fear. There's nothing rational about it. There is no conscious choice that I made from when I was in my early teens that's said, like, I'm going to take and adopt this viewpoint of being afraid of what others think. It really feels like it was given to me, and given to me at a quite like a physical somatic level, right? So I feel like a lot of what I've been doing is trying to get to a place where it can express. And what I was saying before we started, this idea of like, if I can have a conversation with you that feels honest and comfortable without really thinking too much about the fact that this is being recorded, to me, that's authenticity and that's expression. And that's the work of getting to this place of being unfiltered. I think of it a lot as being unfiltered. And as for what I've been doing, honestly, a lot, it kind of feels like every day there are a few things that I do to deepen, to maybe to expand my capacity to be unsheltered. And one of them is, as we're having this conversation, and every conversation that I have through my day, if I'm present enough and if I'm not lost in thought, then just noticing if there's a capacity for slightly more honesty than before. Because I think this is maybe a risky belief, but sometimes I like to play with the belief that in a way you do anything is the way you do everything. And I heard that somewhere, or I didn't come up with that. It's a saying. But it's really nice for beginning to tinker with expression and freedom of expression, knowing that if I'm more honest in a conversation, I'm going to be more honest in my writing, and I'm going to be more honest in what I put on the internet, and I'm going to be more honest when I'm doing a consultation and if I'm doing a drawing or creating a design. So practicing it relationally quite a lot. I get a lot from practicing expression in relationships. And then with ideas and with work, I actually, and I really like Twitter. I think Twitter is freaking phenomenal. And it's been like an incredible practice platform for me when it comes to this, as has my writing. And it's getting to a place of, or trying to get to a place where I notice the ideas that are passing through my field of experience and my field of awareness. And sometimes those ideas come charged with a lot of energy and they want to be expressed and they want to be shared. And there's a very strong filtering mechanism that I've noticed that I have and have historically had. And so some of my practice is actually just trying to let things be created and be released without saying no. And that's as simple as like just tweeting whatever comes into my head while also noticing that it's like there are a lot of voices that say that I shouldn't tweet, right? For multiple different reasons.
Whose voices?
Yeah, I have no idea. I have no idea. There are voices that have my voice, but I have to say I don't really think they're mine. And so we can go into it's probably my mom's voice, like love her and God bless her. And it's probably my dad's voice and the people that I grew up around, right? It's there are these rules of suppression that have been handed down rather than that I've created.
Yeah, I have tears in my eyes right now because when I ask that question often to people, it's they normally take ownership of it and like you did right away. But then the second layer of the answer is like, oh, wait, it was actually this teacher or it was actually this parent or it was actually this way of being in society. And what I found, at least from doing the meditations, was that the voices that were incredibly negative were so often not my own. And I've heard that experience time and time again from people. And it's the recognition of those voices that set you free. Because if you can recognize that as a parent's voice instead of your own, you can then separate yourself from it in some way, the same way you'd separate from bad work and the work itself not being reflective of you. That voice is also not you.
Yeah, it's beautifully, beautifully said and beautifully put. And it's one of those sort of internal ninja moves that you can make that I think do free you up a lot. It's disidentification, right? It's another way to see a thought and not grasp it as myself, is to just start recognizing it as somebody else's voice. And I'll say as well, like, also beginning to recognize, or for me, I got a lot of value from knowing that the voices of suppression, even they don't mean harm, right? Mm. What's been passed to me, what, at least when I think of my parents and when I think of my mother and the rules that they've handed me are not rules that are intended to harm me, no matter how their package, right, it comes from. It's essentially they've taken their blueprint that they've formed that says here's how you can be safe in the world, here's how you can thrive in the world, and they've downloaded it into my system. And so I think similarly to your forgiveness practice, I've gotten a lot from also connecting to the good intentions behind the things that sometimes feel like they're suppressing me and holding me back, right? These rules, these filters, and just noticing, oh wow, you're kind of misguided love that's acting within me rather than a prison guard or a disciplinary or something else.
Yeah, one thing that one of my friends suggested I do is create a list of all the things that I would like to forgive my parents for. Yeah. And I just wrote them down one day. And I haven't presented them with this list because I haven't found an opportunity to do so in person with kindness and love. But I feel as if presenting that list to them in a way that's like, listen, guys, I know you are doing your best with your blueprint. I just want to tell you all the ways in which I want to forgive you because I'm holding on to this. I think that could be incredibly impactful. So I'm going to put a pin in that. Yeah.
Yeah, that would
come
be
back to.
Would you feel comfortable doing that? Does that feel like it requires courage or does it feel relatively easy to do? I'm very curious.
It definitely feels as if it requires courage. Like, because even in the podcast episode that my friend mentioned it, episode 318 with John Fio, my initial reaction to him suggesting it was, why am I scared to do that? That was my follow-up question to him. And it's like, why? Why is it scary to confront our parents with the ways they've let us down?
Yeah. I feel for me, I'd be really worried about hurting. Like, I would really worry about hurting my mom, and my mind instantly goes to all the ways that that would hurt her. And it's this bizarre protection mechanism, right? And maybe that covers deeper layers of fear. But yeah, it's interesting that my reactions are like, wow, that would be so freeing and incredible. And also, dear Lord, will I devastate my parent by doing that?
Yeah. You mentioned before about honesty. You tried to frame your conversations around honesty, and you tried to frame your writing around honesty to the best of your abilities. That makes me ask and consider, is honesty your highest virtue or your highest ideal? And if so, why? And if it's not, what is?
Awesome question. I would probably say love is. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot falls under love, and love is a state that I love, and there's a lot that I could get into there. Honesty feels like a practice, and it also feels like my highest return on investment practice, or just the button that I can push that generates the most goodness in my life. It's also the scariest button for me to push, and it leads to a lot of freedom. Exactly as you were saying earlier, like you said, I think you said one of the keys to life is getting to a place where you notice what's moving within you, and just to be able to move on it and to express it without worrying what other people think or say. And to me, that for me is one of my ultimate forms of freedom. And I think that just speaks to where I started, right? I started from a place where I really didn't have that freedom. For whatever reason, I was really caged in with fears of what others would think. And so it's been slowly just like removing some of the bars of that cage and creating more space to move and to step out. And yeah, for that reason, honesty is, I feel like this being that I am, this system that I am, will be at its highest operational point when I'm at my highest level of expression and honesty and freedom. That's when ideas can just be expressed and intentions can be actioned and thoughts can be manifested into reality. And so that just feels, that feels pretty incredible. Like, we can also call that confidence, right? We can call it agency. We can call it so many things. They're all just different, like, planes of the same shape, essentially, is the way that I think of it or look at it. So yeah, I would say that's why the importance on honesty. And I have many questions around, like, how much honesty is too much honesty, actually? I don't know. And it's a very socially risky game to play. And I'm sure there's so much playing out in my, like, subconsciously that I'm not aware of as well around this. So it's, I'm kind of figuring it out as I go along.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because it's like we want to be truthful about what we're feeling in any given moment, but sometimes the truth can be harmful to someone else in a way that could actually hurt us and hurt them. And is that worth it in that moment? It's dependent on the circumstance. And yeah, I think about that a lot as well. When do you be honest, and what are the characteristics in which you should act on that honesty? It's like, it's an honest expression for when there's a police officer in line at a Starbucks for me to want to grab their gun. But that's just the first reaction of what my body and mind is feeling. That's not necessarily what I should actually do. So,
yep, absolutely. Yeah,
that's an example.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
You mentioned before go for it.
Sorry, I just wanted to add to that. I'm curious if you relate. There is also this, like, other element or aspect of that. I think of myself as a child of the internet. I imagine you're pretty much the same.
Definitely.
And like, what we're doing right now is having a conversation that lives on the internet, right? And we both write and we tweet, and there are all of these things, these creations that exist on this parallel universe called the internet. And if we're practicing honesty there, we're also just expanding our surface area for attacks, is the way that I see it sometimes. Like, honesty is vulnerable, right? And vulnerability is vulnerability for a reason. It is really exposing the softer parts of yourself that, when hit, can generate a lot of damage. And so I also dance with it a lot in that arena of, okay, I can be very honest with my friends in private, how do I create work that's honest, and what will the ramifications of that be in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time? Again, no idea.
One of the things that I have a real difficulty imagining me being honest with is with having children and posting them on the internet, right? Like, it's very difficult for me to imagine a world where I'm showing my children in any way, just because it to me feels uncomfortable. But in a way, I'm being dishonest because I'm not showing my children to the world. And so, yeah, that's something I think a lot about. And I also feel that way about relationship and partner, at least for now, where it's like, I don't want that part of my life to be associated with the podcasting, Twitter creation world. And is that dishonest?
I fully feel that. I fully feel that. Yeah. Like, similarly, I'm not really going to talk about my specific relationship or relationships on my Twitter because it involves another person. And similarly with a child, like, I don't know, I need their permission. I need them to also opt in, right? It has to be their choice. So I really relate. And I don't know, I hope I land on some answer. I hope we collectively land on some answer. But right now it feels like the figuring it out stage.
Yeah. Well, we're the first people to ever do this internet stuff. So I think that's kind of helpful to keep in mind and to give ourselves grace when we inevitably mess up and are dishonest or are not living up to our highest ideal on the internet in some way. It's like, there's no blueprint for this. There's no books written on how to be a good internet citizen because there hasn't been anybody who's ever done that before, which is a wild thing to think about and exciting because we get to lay the foundations for what will be to come. You mentioned before about masculinity and femininity as being something that you are spending a lot of time on and thinking about for the past few years, I think you said before. And I've seen this so often with friends, with internet writings and videos. And I feel like almost there's something in the air that you know what I'm talking about, of like, there are more people who are feeling a sense of they want to know more and they want more understanding on their own masculinity, their own femininity. I don't know why that is exactly, but I've noticed it in enough separate places that it has intrigued me a lot. And the fact that you are also on this wave as well, you know, there's something there. Why have you gotten so interested in this? And what have you learned about masculinity and femininity over the past couple of years that you could share as ways of wisdom?
Sure, absolutely. Again, I would also be super curious about your experience or to hear what your thinking's been on it. So I've noticed that when I speak about masculinity and femininity, sometimes it can push buttons in people that causes hurt in them. So just to start by saying, we can call it yin and yang, if that feels like, I hope that feels better. We can speak about it in those terms and maybe beginning by separating masculinity and femininity from gender, at least the way that I'm feeling into it and thinking about it, to just create some space, because I think there's a lot of baggage and a lot of hurt and a lot of historical harm in this area, understandably. And so it's been very interesting to have conversations and to want to have those conversations without unnecessarily causing pain in people. So just to start off with that, all said with good intention. So I very much feel there's some collective wave for sure. I really agree with that. And I see it in a lot of my friends. I see it very much on the internet. I see it very much in the spaces that I visit and the communities that I've been spending time in, where, at least in the bubbles that I'm in, it's like we're collectively grappling with this duality within ourselves. And we can talk about it as energy, or energy is kind of like different emotions or different parts. But I experience most people as having yin and yang leanings and expressing in ways that we can categorize as yin and that we can categorize as yang. And everybody feels like a very beautiful mix of those two that create a particular person, and a particular expression for that person. And I don't know, I feel for maybe a while or historically now, we've been very limited in the ways that we can express. And those ways have been very tied to our gender. And now I see two things. I see a lot of my woman friends going through a process that I would call reintegrating the feminine or reconciling the feminine. And that's definitely been the process for me. And so I could also be projecting and seeing what I am in the world around me, which would make a lot of sense. And I see a lot of my male friends, my guy friends, actually expanding both. Like for some of them, it's not quite as clear as the women around me. For some of them, there is a movement towards what is more traditionally called masculine. We can call more yang energy, more active energy, more agency. And for some, it's getting in touch with things like spaciousness and nurture and gentleness and developing a deeper relationship with their body and receptivity and all of these things that I find incredibly beautiful. And I get very excited to see them like playing with and leaning into, you know. And yeah, with myself and again, a lot of my women friends as well, I think what I noticed is for many different reasons, I am like writing about this right now, writing a piece called Reconciling the Feminine for myself, which tells a bit of the story. But I cultivated a lot of yang, a lot of masculinity. And that's in both ways that I expressed, but really like the way that I engage with the world and the way that I moved through the world. And there are a lot of different reasons for that. Some of them are personal to me, and some of them are, you know, I for a few years lived in Saudi Arabia, which is easily one of the most sexist countries that definitely existed then and that I've experienced for sure. It's very overt in its sexism and in its kind of hierarchy with men at the very top and women beneath, you know. And so I had a lot of personal issues with being a girl at a young age, and I really admired my dad. I really admired men around me, and I really just saw that the women around me were not having a good time. They existed in a system that penalized them for being women. It was very clear, very overt, and I felt a lot of resistance towards that, and it really led to me rejecting a lot of what I could call yin and feminine in myself, because I saw very early on how softness and receptivity honestly got taken advantage of, and how being very sensitive, for example, meant being completely overwhelmed and in some ways being manipulated. And all of this is very personal. These are really like, you know, the kind of the beliefs that I formed about the world based on what I experienced at a young age. And then I moved into, yeah, a lot of masculinity and definitely had my tomboy phase and moved out of that. And there's the very kind of overt masculinity. And I actually think all of that is just basically fine. And like, it's all of these stages of experiencing who you are as a person, at least for me, and experimenting with different ways that I could be as a person. And like playing more sports and trying out different toys and all of these things, you know. But what was more interesting, or what kicked me onto an exploration of yinness, were the less explicit masculinity, that the more, the kind of more hidden, I'd say, yangness that had really began to shape who I was. And I would say those are things like, were things for me like having intense self-discipline and really using discipline as my main tool for engaging with the world and really sort of imposing my will on the world and having an idea and saying, well, this idea will come to fruition regardless of how I feel or how my body feels or how much it's going to take me. And just kind of having a lot of just like toughness, maybe I'm struggling for words right now, but something along those lines, like a very kind of tough and strict posture to self and to the world. And also, yeah, just a very personal development oriented, very rational, very disconnected from sensitivity and from my own emotions, and really just shutting down a lot of what I now perceive as relatively feminine, we can say. And feminine, again, not just as existing in women, but as an energy that we all have within us, women, men, anybody else as well. And so I began to see that, and also began to see how much the world rewarded me for it. Like, the world really rewards self-discipline. It really rewards anybody who has goals and strives towards those goals. It rewards a kind of top-down approach to life, you know, of having vision and then doing whatever it takes to execute that vision. And as with everything else, I think to go back to what we were talking about earlier, a lot of what's kind of oriented my life has been a desire to just experience less suffering on a moment-to-moment basis, and to get to a place where I feel more content, more peaceful, more harmonious. And those ways of being were very actively causing disharmony in me. They required disharmony to move forward. So I began to notice, like, oh, wow, there is a lot that I'm suppressing. There is a lot that I'm pushing away from my image of self and sense of self that is actually very real and true to my day-to-day experience. Like, I'm feeling a lot of emotion. I'm experiencing a desire for softness. I'm experiencing the very strong flavors of what we can call intuition that aren't particularly rational, but I'm ignoring them because I can't justify them in any way. I'm pretty skilled when it comes to relationship building and communication and just almost social mapping. And I completely negate those abilities and skills because I don't see them as valuable, or previously used to not see them as valuable. So also coming into inhabiting those skills and those ways of being and seeing the value in them. Yeah, I'll stop there. And I'll also say thank you for the space to talk about this. I notice I'm struggling to articulate it, which is really good for me to notice. And it feels large, like I'm trying to explain so much of my life.
I appreciate you saying that. And I'm curious, was it conscious or unconscious, the push towards femininity? And when did you realize that there was a difference between who you were and the new version of femininity that you were able to attain?
So the push was, I don't know if I can find a separation between conscious and unconscious here. I think, I don't know if you feel this as well, but a lot of the times life for me feels like a return to naturalness, or something along those lines, like a dropping. Mostly there's a lot that's being dropped. And it almost felt like if I was going to continue along the path of finding more contentment, of finding more expansiveness, of finding more just comfort in my body, it was inevitable that this idea, the duality of yin and yangness in the ways that I relate to the world it was just a knot that I had to untangle. Otherwise I couldn't get to whatever that sort of state that I was looking to get to. I couldn't get to it without that. So I would say that's my answer to if it was conscious or unconscious. And then remind me what the second question was.
Was there a point where you noticed yourself, oh, I'm way more feminine now than I was at a previous point?
Yeah. So I'd say I noticed the disharmony actually pretty early on, like probably when I was around 15. If I go back and look at my journals, I can see there's a tightness and a tension in what feels real and what I'm allowed to express. And what felt real felt, for lack of a better description, a lot more feminine. And what was expressed felt a lot more masculine. And then that just kind of got subtler and subtler as time went on. And then as for was there a point where I realized I was more feminine, I'd say the framing is more like there was a point where I began to allow more femininity to express myself rather than kind of moving towards more femininity. So
understood.
I'd say the last 2 to 3 years, timelines are very hazy in my mind, especially because of the pandemic, because I'm sure they are in yours. But for sure, around the last 3 years, there's been, let's just say, a lot more comfort and power sitting in what I would call to be feminine, and a lot more like joy and pride in it, and a lot more value actually placed on it, which allows more of it to express.
What advice would you give to women who want or feel they want to allow more femininity into their life, but they've been suppressing that for a while? What steps would you suggest them take?
Let me sit with that for a minute, if it's okay.
Of course. Take as much time as you need.
Thank you. So I'd say I'd open it up to men and women, to anyone who feels there is femininity within them, that for whatever reason they can't even somatically feel without contracting or beginning to shut down or to feel shame, and they also can't express, but it feels true to what they are and to who they are. And I'd say it's probably one of those life complete problems. That's for sure what my experience of it has been. And I'd maybe begin really practically. I'd notice for myself, there's been a hyper focus on self healing and personal development, and what those share is kind of individualistic approach of, this is my work to do, so I'm going to do it alone and I'm going to figure it out alone. And I also feel like I see that around me and a lot of other people. And so I'd start with leaning into the circles around you and leaning into the relationships in your life. So beginning with friends and beginning with areas where you feel safe, and playing around with having containers to express those parts of yourself. And that can be like very intentionally, it can be a conversation that you have with a friend or with a partner to say, hey, there are places where I feel maybe shy or afraid, or I feel this backlog of emotion. And if it would be okay with you, I'd actually love to just allow some of those parts to express and to see how I feel when I express them, and maybe to hear how you receive me when I express them as well. And I find that, you know, like, the healing definitely happens relationally, and maybe we can call this healing, but maybe we can also call it expansiveness. But growth and healing for me happened very relationally, and actually in relationship, platonic or not, both those things are much easier. It's easier to grow. And it feels much more fun as well. So I would say begin with that. And if that feels blocked, because we're social creatures who also really struggle with socializing, like there's a whole thing there. And sometimes there's a lot that gets in the way of being honest with the people around us. So I understand. Then a place to begin could be just sitting or lying and beginning to work with images of what it would be like to express yourself in that way, what it would be like to move through the world with more yin-ness, what that would feel like, and see if you can actually generate those feelings in your body and notice what that feels like, tap into that sensory experience, and then notice if it will grow. And if it doesn't grow, notice what the blockers are, and then allow your attention to meet those blockers. And that blocker could be one of those voices that you and I have been talking about. It could be a parent's voice that says, like, hey, that's weak, you're not allowed to be that way. Or says, like, hey, toughen up, right? Or says, hey, you're not going to get anywhere in life if you keep crying. You know? And I'm like, you know what? The more I cry, the more I get places in life, actually. So that's a whole different topic. And yeah, then just beginning with a very kind of experiential exercise to notice, you know, what are the blockers, and like create space to hear out those blockers, hear out the fears and what they've got to say and why they're inhibiting you from inhabiting that which is more yin. There's a lot of information, there's a lot of wisdom there, and I think you can work with yourself actually in a really nice, very friendly way to start to understand what's intelligent in you that's saying you shouldn't be this way because x, y, z. And then from there, that conversation begins to change both parts of yourself. The part that desires more yinness has more information as to why it hasn't been allowed to do that. And the part that's blocking the yinness now has more information as to why yinness is actually good and beautiful and how it can contribute to your overall happiness. So I'd start there, and there is so much more that we could ideate on and play with. And I think, you know, all sorts of IFS work would be amazing, and potentially psychedelic therapy would be amazing as well, depending on what we're talking about, depending if we're talking about something quite trauma-based and quite block-based, which is what I had a lot of pretty intense experiences that suppress femininity, or if we're talking about something that feels less emotionally explosive or triggering in that way, so you can navigate the terrain alone a little bit more easily. And maybe it's more just like expression or adding colors to a palette versus having a color that's like red taped on the palette that if you try to touch, like, security guards come running towards you.
It's beautiful. I really enjoyed that explanation, and I think a lot of people are going to get a lot of value from it, and we'll have to link down below your piece on that whenever it's ready. Don't want to rush the creativity of it, but yeah. I like to end these podcasts with challenges for people. Mm-hmm. I ask the guests for a challenge to help someone listening do something in their own life. It could be related to the things we've spoke about, or it could be completely unrelated. So I'm curious if a challenge comes to mind.
Sure. Yeah. One of my own like challenges or questions right now, there are two questions, but they're linked. One is if something that's like, what would this look like if it was slower, or how much slower could this be? And then the other question is, how much softer can this be? And it actually starts physically. I've just been noticing that there's so much more capacity for softness in the way that I move. And I'm primarily talking about, you know, when I'm like stretching or doing movement practices or exercising, but also just like moving through the world. But beginning with the physical, because again, I think the way you do anything is the way you do everything. So do it in your movement practice and it'll probably spill everywhere. And just noticing, let's take stretching as an example. I have a tendency, and in speaking to friends, they seem to also have this tendency of like really overstretching, really pushing the stretch to a point where it's painful, to then get the sense that it's working, and beginning to notice that actually my instrument, my body, my everything is like a lot more sensitive. There's a lot more that I can notice. And so if I slow down, and that could mean physically slowing the movement down, including if I'm doing a deadlift, what does it look like to do a deadlift very slowly? Like it's a different exercise than, but just becoming aware of the different sensations and the quality of the movement and having that experience, which for me feels pretty rare. To stretching, what does it look like to do the stretch slowly, but also how soft can the stretch be while still having some noticeable effect? And it's so much softer than what I usually do. Like a stretch is effective at a much earlier stage than where I usually go. Just noticing like, oh wow, this, posing that question of how much slower can this be and how much softer can this be, essentially pulls me into more presence because I'm paying more attention. It's like a much finer level of attention to my body. And I wonder if then that can start spilling over to other things I do, like to my work or to conversations or whatever else. But for now, just starting with that physical exploration and starting with stretching, because I think it makes stretching more pleasurable as well. And that has all sorts of positive ramifications.
I've never once considered that slowness and softness can lead to presence, but you're absolutely right. It definitely does. And that is a remarkable conclusion that I will be thinking about for quite some time after this episode. So thank you for that. And thank you for all your wisdom and energy and just your way of showing up in the world. It's really cool. And I really admire it. So keep doing you. We'll send people to @HeyNibras, @HeyNibras, And anywhere else we should send people to connect with you further?
I think that's a good place to start.
Cool. A lot of great stuff there.
Thank you. And I also want to say, of course, thank you. Thank you for creating space. Thanks for asking beautiful questions. Thank you for reaching out. And also, like, for holding space and listening. I don't think listening is that easy. And I've been on all sorts of tangents, and you've been there, and you've been engaged and been present with me. And I really, it's one of the biggest gifts that you can give me. So I really appreciate it. And for your positivity. And I'm, yeah, also very, very inspired by you. And would love to. I have a lot of questions that I want to ask you. So I'm going to figure out how I'm going to do that, because I'm very curious as well. So yeah, thank you so much.
It's been an absolute pleasure. I appreciate all your kind words and reflected right back at you.
Thank you. Me too.